Thank you. It's always a delight to come to Alma. I always have a very warm welcome, and thank you for your welcome today. It occurred to me, sitting down there, you could do a great comedy routine with this microphone, couldn't you? You could have it drooping down as the speaker spoke, and the speaker crouching lower until they were out of sight. Well, this is the first of a series on John's first letter. So as well as talking about those opening verses, I'm going to say a bit about the letter by way of introduction. And I hope by doing that, I won't take the wind out of the sails of anyone who's going to speak in future weeks. Perhaps I should say, like they do when they're giving out the football results, if you don't want any spoilers, look away now. But then you wouldn't know when to stop looking away, so let's not do that. So first, what was this letter written for? Who was it written to and when? All this is really tied up with the relationship between John's first letter and John's gospel. The relationship is very close. In fact, it's so close that you can't really talk about this first letter without also saying a few things about the gospel at the same time. The gospel seems to have been written for Christian communities, house churches in what's now Western Turkey, communities that had taken shape around the Apostle John, the beloved disciple of the fourth gospel. If tradition is to be believed, John's gospel was written by the beloved disciple himself as a very old man living in Ephesus. And the first letter is so closely related to the gospel, and I think we have to imagine the Apostle John also writing this, probably also from Ephesus to a group of scattered house churches that were connected with him and with his close followers. And I think we can be pretty sure that the letter is written some years after the gospel, because the letter seems to be much more concerned than the gospel is with divisions and errors that were creeping into the churches. And in fact, it seems quite likely that some of those errors and divisions had arisen because people were either accidentally or deliberately misinterpreting things that John had written in his gospel. Let's take an example of that. In John's Gospel, in chapter 8, verses 34 to 6, where Jesus is confronting various critics, he says to his critics, "In very truth, I tell you, everyone who commits a sin is a slave to sin. The slave has no permanent standing in the household, but the Son belongs to it forever. If then the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed." Now, if you took that out of context, you could easily take it to mean that when a person becomes a Christian, they are free from sin, full stop. And it seems that some people probably did take it that way. And so in his first letter, in chapter 1, verse 8, John writes, "If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us." And then two verses later, he says, "If we say we've committed no sin, we make him out to be a liar, and his word has no place in us." Now, of course, John does seem to contradict himself in chapter 3, where he says, "No one who dwells in him sins anymore." But I think I can leave that for someone else to sort out in a future week. Well, no, maybe that's a bit unfair. I think the answer to that apparent contradiction probably lies in the Greek verb in chapter 3, which means to continue doing something, to persist in doing something. So in the English Standard Version, that verse in chapter 3 says, "No one who abides in him keeps on sinning." It's about an attitude in which sin doesn't matter, so you just carry on doing it because there's no motive to not sin. But that's all I'm going to say on that knotty problem. I'm sure someone else will have more to say on it in a future week. So here we have this letter. It's written probably for the same communities as the Gospel was written for, and it shares a lot of the same themes as the Gospel, that Jesus was unique. He was the Christ, that is, the Jewish Messiah. He was God's Son, the true light of the world. He was a real human being, and yet, in some sense, he was also God. His death and resurrection dealt with sin and so provided forgiveness. And furthermore, believers are to love one another in the same way that Jesus loved his disciples. A lot of the language is the same too. You get those pairs of opposites that are there in the Gospel. Light and darkness, life and death, the world and the brethren, and so on. But as I said, there's something else in this letter. It seems as though divisions are creeping in and errors are creeping in. And so John writes of those who are trying to deceive you. And in chapter 4, he mentions false prophets and the spirit of error. Now, we don't know exactly what these false beliefs were, but we can make a fairly good informed guess. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Most scholars, I think, would agree in commenting on this letter that John is trying to correct two particular errors about who Jesus was. On the one hand, there seem to be some believers in the community, probably Jews, who were doubting whether Jesus was the Messiah and also whether he was divine. And by the way, the two don't necessarily go together. The Jews weren't expecting a Messiah who would be divine. On the other hand, there were other believers who were doubting whether Jesus had been truly human. And in connection with that, and I'll explain more in a minute, didn't think that righteous living was important. They thought that you could live as you liked. And John believed these mistakes had to be corrected, not just because it was important to have a right view about Jesus, but also because what people believe affects the way they live. And that's true of us. But these two problems created a third problem. Because the church was dividing, because people were disagreeing over these things, the church was divided instead of united. And John's solution to this third problem, the divisions in the church, isn't to make everybody believe exactly the same thing on every single detail, but it's to emphasize love. The Christian community, he says, must be characterized by love between all its members. So the letter is concerned about three big issues: the divinity of Jesus, the humanity of Jesus, and the unity of the church. And all three are actually there in these opening verses. So finally, let's take a look at them. Verse 1. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we've seen with our eyes, which we've looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. There's a deliberate echo, I'm sure, in this verse of the opening of John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word. In him was life. But as I suggested, there were some among John's hearers who put their own spin on this. Later in the second century, these people would be called Gnostics, Gnostics. A word that comes from the Greek word gnosis, meaning knowledge. In fact, our word knowledge comes from that, except we put a K in front of the N instead of a G in front of it. So it's to do with knowledge, and they were called Gnostics because they put special emphasis on having the knowledge. No, not the knowledge that would make you a good London taxi driver, though in a sense it is knowledge about how to get to your destination. This was secret knowledge about where you'd come from and where you were going. And by the second century, Gnosticism had become a very complicated system of beliefs. In the first century, when John was writing, it was still only just taking shape. But I think we can safely assume that certain key ideas were in the air. Firstly, these Gnostics, or proto-Gnostics, believed that the physical creation, the whole material world, was a mistake. It shouldn't have been created, because God was spirit. He was the creator and ruler of a world of spirit, and a material creation had never been part of his plan. Matter, then, was seen as the work of a lesser being, who had created it either out of sheer foolishness and error or out of rebelliousness against the true God. And our human bodies, being part of this physical world, were prisons in which spirits had become trapped, needing to be set free. So if you came at Christianity with this particular mindset, then Jesus was a redeemer from the spirit realm who came to teach us our true origins, to give us the knowledge about our true nature and our true home. Another aspect of Gnostic beliefs was this, that because the physical creation was thought to be inferior to the spirit realm, then that meant that a redeemer from the spirit realm would never take on a human body, because to take on a human body would pollute a true spirit. So Jesus could only have appeared to be human. He only seemed to be a human being. This idea is sometimes called docetism because of the Greek word that means seeming. Jesus seemed to be human, but in reality he never was. And there are several late so-called Gospels that never made it into the New Testament precisely because they taught this kind of thing. A couple of years ago, the media were making a great fuss about a newly discovered gospel called the Gospel of Judas. That was one of these Gnostic gospels. It doesn't give us any new historical information about the real Jesus. It's just another of a type of writing we already have plenty of, which shows us what these Gnostics believed. If you've read the Da Vinci Code, you'll know that Dan Brown makes a lot of play and no doubt a lot of money out of this idea that the Gnostic Gospels were the original Christian writings. They were excluded from the New Testament by the Emperor Constantine in the 4th century. Well, if you don't know it already, let me reassure you that all that is sheer nonsense. Of course, the full contents of the New Testament weren't decided till about 3 centuries after Jesus had lived and died, but Constantine had nothing to do with deciding what went into it, and most importantly, already by the early 2nd century, the 4 Gospels we do have, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, they were already the yardstick by which people decided what was orthodox and what was heresy. So back to John and the first letter. As I said, it was a Gnostic belief that the creator of this world was an inferior God and couldn't possibly be the same as any redeemer that God would send into the world. But John roundly contradicts this right at the start of the letter, just as he does, by the way, at the start of the gospel, where he says, "In the beginning was the Word, all things were made through him, without him was not anything made, and the Word became flesh." He's saying it very clearly at the start of his gospel. The one who came to redeem is the same as the one who made this world, or the one through whom this world was made. You can't split the two. The one who came to reveal the Father was the one through whom all things were made. And he expands on that at the beginning of this letter to tackle the other big Gnostic stumbling block, that Jesus could not have been truly human. So he says, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we've looked at, and our hands have touched. You see what he's doing here? He's saying, in effect, there's no doubt Jesus was fully human. Because I and the other apostles, we saw him, we heard him, we touched him. He was as real a human being as you and me. That's why he includes "we touched with our hands." He wants to stress the physicality of Jesus. He was no mere appearance. He was a real human being. He's spelling out what he says at the start of the gospel. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. In the gospel, of course, he goes on, we have seen his glory, glory as of an only Son from the Father. But that could be misunderstood if you came at it with the wrong set of ideas in the back of your mind. So here in the first letter, he rules out any possible misunderstanding. When I say flesh, he says, I really mean human flesh. We saw, heard, and touched with our hands the Word made flesh. And he comes back to this theme in chapter 4, where he talks about recognizing false prophets. And he says, by this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God. Why does John lay such great emphasis on this? Well, apart from the fact that he simply knew that Jesus had been a real human being, he'd also been around enough to see that what people believe affects the way they live. If you believe the material world is inferior, if you think it's evil, it's polluted, it's worthless, it's only fit for destruction, it will affect the way you live in it. It will affect the way you treat your own body and the bodies of others. We know that by the 2nd century, there were Gnostics around who lived sexually immoral lives because they believed the body wasn't the real person. It was going to be discarded. It was merely a disposable container. You could do what you liked with it. John doesn't want any such ideas to get into his Christian community. But does John's concern about such ideas have anything to say to us? Well, if we think about it, there are plenty of semi-Gnostic ideas around today. They're very hard to eradicate. As Tom Wright points out in his book, Surprised by Hope, there are plenty of our favourite hymns that are very confused about life in the age to come, and they contain a heavy dose of Gnostic notions. Some talk about death in terms of escaping from the physical creation into a purely spiritual heaven. Take the line from Abide With Me that says, heaven's morning breaks and earth's vain shadows flee. Or what about the chorus that has the line, this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. What's that got to do with praying, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven? What's happened to the New Testament vision of a renewed earth, transformed, sure, but still having continuity with this one? What's happened to the New Testament teaching about a resurrection body, again, transformed, but having continuity with this one? Of course, Paul says the resurrection body is a spiritual body, but that still means it's a body, not a disembodied spirit. If Jesus' resurrection is a foretaste of ours, as the New Testament says it is, then it shows us that matter will still matter in the age to come. Matter will still matter in the age to come. Now, if you've read on into John's letter, you might be saying, well, hang on a minute, doesn't John himself in the next chapter tell us not to love the things of the world because the world is passing away? Yes, he does, but you've got to remember that in this letter, as also in the Gospel, John uses the word world in a particular way. He doesn't mean the physical creation. He means human systems that leave God out of account and so end up opposing God. Even so, God loved the world so much that he gave his only Son, that whosoever believes in him may not perish, but have eternal life. There's no reason in anything John has written to denigrate or devalue the material world. As C.S. Lewis put it, God likes matter. He invented it. So the Gnostic problem is very much alive, and it isn't a trivial side issue. It goes right to the heart of what we believe about creation, whether we set a right value on the things that God has made, where we stand on environmental issues, and how in practice we live with our neighbours on this earth. Just ponder this for a moment. The early Christians who turned the world upside down, and who in the second and third centuries were persecuted by the Roman Empire, they were not reading Gnostic Gospels and being preoccupied with some interior, detached spirituality. They were reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They were the followers of a real Jesus who'd gone through a real crucifixion and a real resurrection. They were galvanized by this faith to live righteously and to oppose evil, even when evil took the form of the Roman Empire. No one got thrown into prison or thrown to the lions for reading the Gospel of Judas. You didn't get persecuted for being detached. You got persecuted for being involved. So John tries to help those with Gnostic leanings to see the error of that way of thinking. But there were also other believers who were struggling, and these were probably Jewish believers. They had the opposite problem. Rather than finding it hard to believe that Jesus had been truly human, they found it hard to believe that Jesus was God. For a Jew, there was a clear dividing line between God and his creation, and therefore between divine and human. Nobody could be both, which makes it pretty amazing that within a short time after Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, there were Jewish converts offering prayer and worship to Jesus alongside God. They hadn't got a worked-out doctrine of the Trinity, but their experience of the risen Jesus told them that Jesus was in some sense the embodiment of Israel's God. This was a truly amazing leap. It wasn't just that Jews refused to worship pagan gods and Roman emperors. That's to be expected. The point was they refused to worship members of the home team as well. There were Old Testament characters like Enoch and Melchizedek and Elijah, who they believed had been specially exalted by God to be his heavenly agents. But they never, ever worshipped or prayed to them. They didn't worship or pray to any of the angels. So for a first century Jew to worship anyone other than God was unthinkable. It's as unthinkable as it would be for a modern Muslim to start worshipping Muhammad. But with Jesus, the unthinkable had happened. A line that Jews had never crossed before had been crossed. And understandably, for many first century Jews, Jesus as God was a belief too far. Jesus as a man, as a prophet, perhaps even as Messiah, because the Messiah didn't have to be divine, all that was okay, but Jesus as God, that was another matter. But John says it very clearly at the start of his gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In other words, this same Word that became flesh, that became a human being, Jesus, was God. And here at the beginning of the letter, we find the same thought in slightly different words. This Word of life, which was seen and heard and touched and was from the beginning, he says, was with the Father. And he goes on to call the Word of life the Son, and identifies the Father and the Son so closely that he can say, whoever confesses the Son has the Father also. So John is achieving a fine balancing act in these first few verses. He holds together the humanity and the divinity of Jesus. He knew that both were true and that both were essential if people were to grasp the gospel properly. Only the Word that was God could show what God was like. Only the Word made flesh, the incarnate Son of God, could say, "He who's seen me has seen the Father." Only God could break the slavery of sin. But only as a human being could he do it on behalf of other human beings. And so finally and very briefly, John comes to the subject of unity. In verse 3, he says, "The point of making sure that they have the truth about Jesus is so that you too may have fellowship with us. And indeed, our fellowship," he says, "is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ." So he's talking about a lot more here than just being in agreement with each other. True fellowship among Christians, he says, is sharing fellowship with the Father and the Son. And this, as he spells out later, is all to do with loving one another. But someone perhaps who knows more about loving one another will tell you about that in 3 weeks' time. Let's pray.